Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
You can visit my blog at thinkwingradio.com. You can follow me on Twitter at thinkwingradio. I'm on Facebook. Andrew has his thing.
Yes, I do. I am at Dominate I, that's E-Y-E, on Twitter, and dominateeye.tumblr.com.
So we're pre-recording this show on what is now Sunday, June 21st, at the ungodly hour, 5:15 a.m., just because. Black Lives Matter, want to say that again, and as a reminder, July 14th is election day for the runoffs. I have mailed in my ballot because I mail my ballot in, and that's okay. HarrisVotes.com is where you find election information, or VoteTexas.gov if you're outside Harris County and don't know where else to check. And July 15th is still tax day. Yay. Okay, so for those that have occasionally compared Trump and his regime to Hitler and the Nazis, and for those who used to say that was beyond the pale, now there's this, according to the Washington Post, article by opinion writer Greg Sargent, leaked document makes Trump campaign's use of Nazi-era symbol look worse. Apparently, you may have heard by now, the Trump campaign is under fire for employing a symbol once used by Nazis to identify political prisoners in a new batch of Facebook ads. They used a red inverted triangle that appeared alongside a warning about the dire threat posed by Antifa, or as some people mispronounce it, Antifa. An internal Department of Homeland Security document makes the campaign's use of the symbol and its justification for it look even worse by undercutting the claim that Antifa represents any kind of threat. The document, which talks about protest-related threats to law enforcement, dated June 17th, makes no mention at all of Antifa. So, essentially, the argument, to whatever extent it has any validity, that, yes, there are political agitators and the upside-down red triangle. No, you know what? This is now we're talking Nazi territory. We're talking fake media, enemy of the people, separating parents and children without any plan for reuniting them, and arguably in many cases for no valid reason, putting them in concentration camp like conditions. Talking racist rhetoric, retweeting white supremacy. I mean, you know, we're close. We're pretty much almost there. We have about 5 months until the election. And remember, the only poll that matters is the one on election day. So I'm not going to read the whole rest of this that I have. It's going to be on the website. But the people I'm talking to, the people that listen to KPFT for the most part, I'm not worried about you guys showing up to vote. But you remember to remind other people to go out and vote. Because at the end of the day, as the old saying goes, if the 99% voted, the 1% wouldn't matter. AP News on June 16th had an article by David Klepper report Russia-linked disinformation operations still active. Kremlin-linked social media disinformation sought to interfere with the 2016 election and has continued to work to divide and discredit Western democracies, a new report finds. But, at least in some cases, its effectiveness has been limited by its own cautious tactics. Dubbed secondary infection, with a K, to make it look Russian by researchers, the network was part of Russia's bid to use social media to polarize Americans ahead of the 2016 elections. It's been linked to similar efforts in Ukraine, France, Britain, and elsewhere. And since 2014, it has posted thousands of times on more than 300 internet platforms. Content from secondary infection includes posts denigrating Muslims, immigrants, Hillary Clinton, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, some posts have used forged documents. So just because you see a PDF doesn't mean that it's actually a real PDF document or bogus commentary. So I guess the main point here to remember is Russia's still tinkering with our country, and it's important to be alert to the media that you consume and the credibility that you give it and the degree to which you check multiple sources in order to see if the media you consume is more or less accurate. And now for something completely different, it's... Okay, not Monty Python's Flying Circus. But different for ThinkWing Radio. Now, many of you are familiar with the term terraforming. In short, it's typically used to describe turning an otherwise uninhabitable world into an Earth-like or Terra-like world. Now, in the face of global warming and climate change, many scientists, biologists, environmentalists, engineers, geneticists, and others are examining naturalistic ways to keep the Earth humanly habitable. I first kind of got interested in this area of research about 10 years ago when I encountered a magazine in a doctor's office and took the magazine home, for which I have felt eternally guilty, but it was a really interesting article. Some scientists and naturalists are looking back at tens of thousands of years ago when Earth was cooler and had much lower CO2 levels in the air. It was a time of what's called megafauna. Now, this term often is considered to be large or giant animals like bison or like the giant tree sloth. But actually, the most common thresholds used as a definition for megafauna are animals weighing over about 40 kilograms or 90 pounds, basically mass comparable to a small human.
Oh, okay.
So there's actually a definition for this. I got this out of Wikipedia, so there's a link. Most of us think about megafauna as being like 1,000 or 2,000 pounds, about 1,000 kilograms. So animals like the saber-toothed tiger, mastodons, mammoths, there are really very few megafauna left compared to what was in existence 40 or 50,000 years ago, and almost none in the Americas.
Yeah.
But these animals actually affected the climate, or at least that now is current thinking slash theory. So when we think of these large animals, for example, what now is forest in North America, or at least what was before the Europeans came here, in the time of megafauna, in the time when or before the first humans came to North America, a lot of that was grassland. Because these large animals would eat or knock down seedlings or saplings and graze. So a lot of trees didn't have the chance to grow into the enormous trees that we now think of as being part of forests. When those large megafauna were wiped out or became extinct and forests became more common in North America, that changed the climate. You had fewer animals emitting methane, which, I mean, it's part of a natural carbon cycle, but it does affect the atmosphere and it does go up and down.
Sure.
And when you had more forests, you now had less CO2 in the air, which made the climate cooler. So there is an interactivity between living creatures and climate.
Yeah.
It's a biosphere.
Yeah.
So there is an article that was actually, there are several articles here that I'm going to connect that was talking about whether introducing certain kinds of animals in certain kinds of environments can actually help to combat not so much climate change per se, but global warming overall. So the first article is whether filling the Arctic with giant animals can slow climate change. This is kind of along the lines of the article that I ran across 10 years ago, where in order to protect the Arctic from the ravages of climate change, a team of scientists is asking whether filling the Arctic with hordes of grazing animals like reindeer and bison would help keep permafrost frozen by trampling it, which sounds counterintuitive, but when they explain it, it makes a little more sense. When snow falls in the Arctic, it serves as a layer of insulation between the soil and the more frigid air above it. As climate worsens, as our world is warming, that insulation threatens to allow the soil's temperature to rise to the point that the permafrost begins to thaw. When you have these large herbivores dispersing the snow, exposing it to the cold air during the winter, it gives the soil a chance essentially to refreeze, to recool. So that's one of the lines of thought. And then this article was actually based on a longer CBS News article from April of this year called Releasing Herds of Animals into the Arctic Could Help Fight Climate Change, Study Finds. So again, they're talking about horses, bison, reindeer. The study, which is a computerized simulation based on real-life, on-the-ground data, finds that with enough animals, 80% of all permafrost soils around the globe could be preserved, which is to say, could be kept frozen. That's important because as the permafrost thaws, you have organic material that, while it's sort of been in the deep freeze for tens of thousands of years, starts to decay, and it starts to release methane. And there's also methane that is already frozen in the ground, and that starts to get released, and you end up with a vicious cycle. So the research, which was inspired by an experiment in the town of Chersky, Siberia, by a scientist named Sergei Zimov, he resettled grazing animals to a piece of the Arctic tundra in Siberia more than 20 years ago. And then there's the explanation that I just gave you already. So in the winter, the permafrost in Chersky, Siberia stays at about 14 degrees Fahrenheit, but the air can be much colder, dropping down to about 40 below zero. Keep in mind that at a certain point, you have what they call a freeze line, and below the freeze line, the Earth is actually warmer, and that heat is constantly trying to work itself to the surface, which is why the ground temperature can be warmer than the air temperature.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a thing called a freeze line. Like in New York, the freeze line in the depths of winter is something like 4 feet down. In Houston, in the depths of what we laughingly call winter, it can be as little as 6 inches. So the idea behind Zimov's experiment, what he calls his Pleistocene Park experiment, was to bring grazing animals with their stamping hooves into the land to disperse the snow, compress the ground, and chill the soil. It turns out, at least in his small area with his relatively limited data, it seems to have worked. So you had about 100 resettled animals in a 1 square kilometer area, which is small. They cut the average snow cover in half, reducing the insulating effect, exposing the soil to the overlying colder air, and intensifying the freezing of the permafrost. So the animal herds repopulating the tundra, if you were to do this to scale, the ground might warm only about 4 degrees Fahrenheit, about 2 degrees centigrade. That would be enough to preserve 80% of the current permafrost, at least through the end of this century. So, you know, a little time gives us a little time.
Yeah.
Well, so, yeah, go ahead. I was going to ask you, Andrew.
Some of these, I forget which article specifically it was. Probably could have been both of them, because one was based off of the other. One of them also mentioned something about sort of other scientists' reactions being like, well, it's an interesting line of questioning, but, you know, it's very much not practical. I mean, you'd have to transport a bunch of animals to the Arctic and ensure that they can survive down there. And I think that while that is fair, and maybe specifically this exact idea isn't going to be the one that's end up deployed. It's worth investigating because it could lead to the development of other, you know, approaches to preserving the permafrost and slowing the degradation of the climate, sort of based off of these ideas. I mean,
it's worth noting that yesterday's crackpot scientific idea is today's dogma.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, and, you know, thinking outside the box, it's kind of like starting a business. You know, there's an interesting statistic to new businesses. Half of all new businesses fail in the first year.
Mm-hmm.
Half of what's left fails in the second year.
Mm-hmm.
Half of what's left fails in the third year.
Right.
At that point, you've got about 75% of new businesses failing in the first 3 years, and there's no guarantee that what survives is actually making money.
Mm.
But some do.
Yeah.
And hope springs eternal.
Sure.
And the fact is, enough do that we have entire economic systems based upon that. So, you know, I remember when plate tectonics was considered a radical idea. What? Huh. Sections of the Earth moving around within geologic time? No way. And that was an idea that was introduced by a geologist in the 70s that wasn't accepted as essentially dogma for about 20 or 30 years after a lot of other scientists had accumulated a lot more data because he kept persisting in this idea and presenting papers on it.
Mm.
So yesterday's crackpot idea literally can be today's dogma.
Yeah, fair enough.
So, by the way, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM, co-host Andrew Ferguson. And do remember that we are community-supported radio. We rely upon our listeners, those who are in a position to do so, to help support the station. Donate what you can when you can. You can do that either by going to kpft.org and clicking on the donate link, or you can text 713-526-5738 and the word give, and you'll have a little interactive thing. And it's nice if you choose ThinkWing Radio as the show that you're donating to. We would appreciate that. It's kind of like a rating system. But on the other hand, it all goes to the same cause. So
yes.
Whatever you can do is appreciated, large, small, or in between. So getting back to our topic, which today is kind of about terraforming and environmental change, ecological manipulation, global warming, to the extent that humans have caused it, can humans actually be proactive in helping to mitigate it?
Yeah.
What might be some of the problems and some of the solutions there? So here's a problem,
well,
ABC. Go ahead.
I think something's kind of clever there. Terraforming the Earth is kind of interesting.
Radical idea, right?
Yeah, because, you know, in science fiction, at least, terraforming is something that they do for, you know, desert planets, even though the desert is an ecosystem of its own, but planets that can't support
have CO2 atmospheres like Venus.
Yes, planets that can't support human life are the candidates for terraforming. And there's plenty of science fiction that imagines the Earth, you know, as a desolate wasteland after some, you know, big nuclear war or climate change ravages it or something. And so they would need to terraform the Earth in order to get it back to the way it was before. But
in a sense, re-terraform.
Yes, in a sense, re-terraforming it. But I think this is the first time I've really thought about the concept of terraforming it while it's still capable of supporting life in order to try and lengthen the amount of time it can do that. That's interesting.
And think about the concept of living in an experiment and crossing your fingers and hoping for the best, or not living in an experiment and then crossing your fingers and hoping for the best.
Yeah.
That's kind of the place we're in now.
Mm.
So, this article from BBC also should concern you when you think about permafrost, that poisons that have been essentially preserved in ice can be released by melting permafrost.
Mm.
So, pollution, anthrax, nuclear waste, viruses, it's all back up for grabs. The article goes on to say that permafrost, which up until now has been permanently frozen land and soil, is thawing out and revealing hidden secrets. Aside from Pleistocene fossils, there are massive carbon and methane emissions, toxic mercury, ancient diseases. The organic-rich permafrost holds an estimated 1,500 billion tons of carbon. Now, let's just reframe that, 1.5 trillion tons of carbon.
Hmm.
So, I mean, you can't wrap your head around it. Just kind of think about it.
That's a lot of carbon.
That's a lot of carbon. That's about twice as much carbon in the atmosphere as is in the atmosphere now, and three times as much carbon as is stored in all the world's forests. 1.5 trillion tons of carbon in just permafrost.
Hmm.
Mind you, that does not count the methane that's frozen at the bottom of the ocean, which is a concern as the ocean warms. But that's for a different show, perhaps. Or perhaps not. We'll see.
We'll
see. So, according to Emily Osborne, who is an Arctic researcher for NOAA, the National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration?
Yes.
You know, it's 5 a.m, guys. You got to cut me some slack here.
It's one of those acronyms you never really need to know until you need to know it.
Well, the funny thing is that it's the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, and it sounds like NOAA and the ARC.
Yeah.
And in a way, they're connected. And this may have been named before they decided that acronyms should speak to something other than what they actually mean.
Hmm.
So it may actually be coincidental, but that's neither here nor there. She says we're seeing a big increase in thaw of permafrost. The landscape is physically crumbling as a result. And they're changing so fast that researchers hadn't even anticipated these kinds of changes. So, in other words, yes, the climate scientists may have been wrong. It's even worse. So, you know, there is that aspect of climate scientists not being exactly right. It can actually be worse.
Mm.
So she says methane and CO2 are not the only things being released from the ground. That in the summer of 2016, a group of nomadic reindeer herders began falling sick from a mysterious illness. Rumors began circling of the Siberian plague, and that was last seen in 1941. When a young boy and 2,500 reindeer died, the disease was ultimately identified as anthrax.
Wow.
Its origin was a defrosting reindeer carcass, a victim of an anthrax outbreak 75 years previously.
Wow.
The 2018, yeah. I mean, this is scary stuff. If you want to talk apocalyptic,
yeah,
you know, we could be there.
But it's also kind of fascinating in a way that ice can preserve, well, obviously ice can preserve many things, but that something that died 75 years ago encased in ice can still be infectious.
I think that it's mentioned a little further on here, that they have, here we go, we're getting to it. The 2018 Arctic report speculates that diseases like Spanish flu, smallpox, or plague that have been wiped out might be frozen in the permafrost. That in 2014, in a French study, they took a 30,000-year-old virus that was frozen within permafrost and warmed it back up in the lab, and it promptly came back to what, in viral terms, is life.
Huh.
30,000 years.
Wow.
So, you know, we've been seeing diseases leap from animals to humans. Mm-hmm. We're living through it now with COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
We lived through it with SARS. Possibly the 1918 flu had leaped from something else into humans. And in addition to all of that, there may be pathogens that have been frozen for literally tens of thousands of years, possibly before there were modern humans, because there's ice that's over 100,000 years old that still exists in the Antarctic, for example.
Right.
And it's possible that diseases that have never infected humans may suddenly find hosts. And it may not be humans. It may be livestock. It may be crops. Because we don't know what may have existed 100,000 years ago that died out everywhere except in the ice pack. So just something to be a little daunting.
Yeah, if you weren't afraid of the permafrost thawing all at once before, now you sure are.
Well, you know, I think aside from the people that don't believe that there's such a thing as global warming, that they think climate change is maybe just a natural cycle, and there are natural cycles. You know, there are other people who feel that in certain parts of the world, it's a benefit. So, for example, Putin, who maybe is not that concerned about climate change because or global warming, let's say, because Siberia is so cold that global warming kind of works for him, hypothetically. Mm. You know, so.
Yeah, there was a news article about the Russian government evaluating certain parts of the country for their possibility of being farmland after climate change. Yeah.
I mean, there may be winners and losers before life as we know it becomes extinct.
Mm.
Just a way of framing it.
Mm.
Another concern that goes back to the melting permafrost is that the element mercury, the metal, is also entering the food chain because of thawing permafrost.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The Arctic is home to the most mercury on the planet. The U.S. Geological Survey estimates there's a total of 1,656,000 tons of mercury trapped in polar ice and permafrost, which is roughly twice the global amount in all other remaining soils, oceans, and the atmosphere. Mercury, for those who are not familiar, is not only toxic, but it binds with organic material in places where you have a high organic matter content. Organisms' bodies don't remove it, they don't metabolize it, they don't eliminate it, so it bioaccumulates up the food web. Mm. This was a frequently discussed topic several decades ago when you were advised not to eat tuna more than once a week, because mercury was moving its way up the ocean food chain, and tuna, as carnivores, were eating fish that were eating animals that were eating plankton that had taken up mercury. So it becomes increasingly concentrated in the biosphere as it moves up the food chain.
Yeah, I've heard of references to that, yeah.
So the mercury binds with organic material. Organisms don't remove it. It bioaccumulates up the food web, and permafrost in the article is almost the perfect storm. You have a lot of mercury. It's released into wetland systems in the right environment for organisms to take up the mercury, and then it heads up the food web, and that becomes a concern for wildlife, humans, and commercial fishing.
Mm.
Going back to Putin as an example, are there some positives of a thawing Arctic? Well, the article says a greener Arctic could see more trees and vegetation take root. It could sequester more carbon. It could offer new grazing land for animals. And one of the people interviewed in the article agrees that the Arctic is greening. But she adds that studies of animal populations suggest that warmer temperatures also increase the prevalence of disease, viruses. Mm. They see more caribou and reindeer becoming more sickly. And in her words, it is just not an environment that is suited to thrive at these warmer temperatures. So now that takes us back to our earlier story, right?
Yeah.
Where we're talking about putting large herbivores and perhaps some carnivores as well to balance the thawing permafrost by exposing warming soil to colder air temperatures, thereby either refreezing it or keeping it frozen. Can the environment support the kinds of animals that you would need to do that? Well, then you get into kind of an if-then flowchart. If you put a few animals there and they find a way of surviving, will that create an environment more suitable for more animals? Will some of the animals die? Will some of the animals thrive? Do humans have the right to play God and try to create a new kind of ecosystem? Well, that brings us to our next story, which we'll get to right after our station ID. Listen.
And we'll be back with more Think Week Radio after these messages.
Yeah, it's 5:45 in the morning now, so you know, it's almost like we've had a couple of shots of tequila at this point.
Yes.
You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. Andrew Ferguson is my co-host. Remember that KPFT relies on your support. KPFT.org, hit the donate button, or text 713-526-5738, the word give, and it will take you through some automated responses. Please consider donating for Think Wing Radio, but donating to KPFT is the thing that matters. Also, I do have a website, thinkwingradio.com. Unless I screw up, I generally have a post of the show when it airs so that you can see everything that I am discussing, including the stuff I don't read, including links to take you to the articles. It's something I'm actually very proud of. I feel like there's an enormous amount of information there if you want to dig into it. And, of course, I'm on Twitter, at ThinkWing Radio. I'm on Facebook, ThinkWing Radio. It's a theme. So back to our story, the terraforming idea. There is an article in BBC.com called The Island with a Key to Our Future. Scientists are looking to a 19th century terraform experiment on Ascension Island for clues on how to reverse negative global trends like deforestation and bushfires. And I thought this article fit in so great with what we've been discussing. It's actually kind of a first-person article, so I'm converting it into a third-person narrative. From the sea, volcanic Ascension Island looks as if it's smoldering. Big mid-Atlantic swells roll up from the Southern Ocean, explode onto the rugged cinder sand shoreline. It's all black lava and red rubble and a forbidding landscape that once earned the island the tourist-repelling descriptor of hell with the fire put out. Now, that's a tourist slogan.
Mm.
Green Mountain on this island is a leafy oddity. Its flourishing cloud forest is a testament to both the ingenuity of humans and the resilience of nature. Planted on a desolate hilltop less than 160 years ago, the forest began on a whim and started attracting the notice of scientists around the world. It upends traditional ideas of conservation. Green Mountain offers the hopeful idea that man-made ecosystems can improve our environment. And as the climate crisis ravages landscapes and leads to catastrophic damage such as the recent bushfires in Australia, the thriving jungle on Ascension bolsters the argument that maybe we can regenerate a forest or create one using concepts from this remote and often forgotten place. Apparently, it was during a visit in 1836 when Charles Darwin pointed out the island's most obvious flaw. It's treeless. Naked hideousness, as he called it, made it a tough place to live. Inspired by his friend Darwin's theories about turning the arid landscape into a garden, a botanist, Joseph Hooker, came up with a plan. He would plant seedlings from around the world. Trees could catch the mist and increase rainfall over the scorched island and make it livable, essentially creating a virtuous cycle. The opposite, by the way, of a vicious cycle. The plan was a success. And in 1860, John Bell, the island's horticulturalist, supervised the planting of some 27,000 trees and shrubs, which resulted in the development of enough soil to grow crops. According to traditional, and this is where it gets interesting, according to traditional ecological principles, this hodgepodge of endemic grasses and ferns combined with more than 300 non-indigenous species should never have evolved into a thriving ecosystem. Complex forests are thought to take millions of years of careful self-selection to develop. But the man-made ecosystem on Green Mountain, where introduced species and island plants seem to have ultimately evolved together, doesn't fit that paradigm. It's neither garden nor wilderness. Dave Wilkinson, an ecology professor, says, what you see on Green Mountain is something that traditional researchers wouldn't have looked at twice because it's completely dominated by non-native species. It would have been of no interest. He added that ecologists have traditionally focused on the natural bits, not the things that aren't supposed to be there. Those things were considered bad. And this kind of goes back to an earlier point in our discussion about since humans are creating a new climate because of global warming, maybe humans could also have a role in mitigating the effects of climate change in certain areas. And maybe what used to be natural there can't survive there anymore and therefore may need some human intervention for its benefit. So until recently, conservation meant getting rid of invasive species, allowing a landscape to return to the way it was before people got involved. On isolated and treeless Gough Island, I think it's pronounced, 2,000 nautical miles further south, nautical mile, I believe, is 1.2 miles, the English house mouse, this is an interesting story, offers a classic example of what goes wrong when humans mess with the environment. In his book, The New Wild, Why Invasive Species Will Be Nature's Salvation, author Fred Pierce describes how house mice got to the island from passing ships, and then over decades of windswept isolation, the mice mutated and turned carnivorous. They now consume a ton of seabirds a day, threatening the local bird population.
Wow.
Animals
a ton of seabirds.
A ton. And a literal ton. Not just a lot, but a ton. And, you know, this is nature, animals evolving to fill empty niches.
Hmm.
They didn't have a carnivorous competitor, so they became the carnivores.
Yeah.
So Dave Wilkinson, the ecology professor at Lincoln, UK, took the idea further in his controversial 2004 essay, The Parable of Green Mountain, challenging the theory that introduced species don't belong, and putting forward the argument that man-made ecosystems like Green Mountain could play a critical role in our future. Now, that isn't to say that we should change or manipulate every environment, which
right.
I guess we do pretty much anyway, but that there may be circumstances where manipulating an environment is really just aiding its evolution forward, rather than perhaps desertification. So over the next few years, this idea gained traction. And in 2006, the term novel ecosystem was developed by an ecologist named Richard Hobbs to describe places like Green Mountain that were irreversibly changed by human intervention and may not need to be fixed. A senior ecologist at the ICON Science Research Group in Australia says that proponents of novel ecosystem approaches have a pragmatic view of conservation. In her words, the concept offers more flexibility. Given the realities of climate change, human impact, and the small amount of funds usually available for conservation, she says that by accepting the changes humans have made, ecologic restoration is more manageable. The landscape doesn't have to revert to what it was. We just want diversity and balance. So as ecosystems are thrown into chaos through fires and storms and disease brought on by the climate crisis, it's becoming more about resilience, at least according to this particular theory. It's becoming more about resilience than necessarily restoration. If a group of plants survive and some of them are non-indigenous, we don't necessarily want to rip them out. Diversity in the ecosystem is more important than a plant's origin. Going even further, Wilkinson says the novel ecosystem approach allows ecologists to account for some of the forces that might shape ecosystems of the future. He says 20 years ago, conservation managers would never consider planting a non-native species. But now we know the value of having a mixture of trees on the site. So if a tree pathogen, a fire or storm comes through, you don't lose absolutely everything. With the novel ecosystem approach, conservationists have the freedom to rebuild a now dry floodplain with drought-resistant species, or replant a fire-ravaged landscape with plants that thrive in a hotter region. Time went on, and longtime Ascension Island conservation officer Stedson Stroud discovered that a species of parsley fern that had been thought to be extinct hadn't actually been wiped out by the new plants, and that some of the island's other native plants actually grew better because of the introduced species. He says that in the past 5 to 10 years, a shift in thinking meant conservationists began to see the accident of Green Mountain as something optimistic. It's a tropical forest on a site that didn't used to have a tropical forest. So to kind of sum this up, I think what we may see going forward, these are my words now, I think what we may see going forward is sort of an ongoing battle, a dynamic tension between what you might call ecological purists and what we might call novel system ecologists. So in a changing world caused by a changing climate, which is predominantly caused by human industrial activity, which is right? What we might call ecological Ludditism, or perhaps ecological radicalism. So, I mean, I think that this is a very interesting philosophical, moral, ethical, practical question.
Yeah.
Or questions, as the case may be. Is there a right or wrong here? Or is there a should and should not? I don't know. I think it's a mixture, as most compromises are. There's no purest approach to it that's necessarily ideal.
The argument of, or the discussion, perhaps, of the ethics of intervention in, you know, political intervention, ecological intervention, social intervention, all these sorts of things, is is a debate that has been raging for centuries, millennia. And this could certainly be yet another argument in that. I think that, as with a lot of things, nuance will probably end up being the right approach. I mean, there are going to be situations where, especially like the article talks about, like just after a natural disaster or something, where, you know, it doesn't necessarily matter if what regrows in an area is what was there originally. It's what will probably best survive, according to what we know, for those conditions. And ultimately, it's more important in those situations if that there's a forest or whatever ecosystem is supposed to be there at all.
A forest for the trees.
Yeah, a forest or a, you know, plains or, you know, a desert, whatever. As long as there's something there rather than nothing. But in other cases, there may be, and historical preservation may come into this in some degree as well. There are probably, I think, going to be places where it's deemed important to keep an area looking as it is, quote unquote, supposed to look, as it used to look a certain amount of time ago. And you know, this could be as frivolous as wanting to have a living museum somewhere, and you know, wanting to make sure that the surrounding land looks right for the era where the museum is supposed to be representing. Or,
well, I think one. I'm sorry. Go ahead, and then I'll break.
Yeah, it could be, you know, deeper. It could be about being able to study certain ecosystems and make sure that there's a place where people can go to see, like, this is what happens here and this is what it's supposed to look like.
Of course, that might involve doming areas. I mean,
yes,
I think it's going to come down to an important question of what's more important, the survival of species or the survival of ecosystems.
Mm.
Is it possible that preserving a species may require moving it from its ecosystem?
That's a very good way of putting it, I think.
Now, there's also, I occasionally like to make Star Trek analogies.
Yes.
And, you know, there's the prime directive, mm-hmm. not to interfere in the normal development of a society. But then there's what is really a great episode, A Piece of the Action from the original series. And one of the things they discuss is a prior group of Earth visitors had essentially messed with the planet's culture, and they had learned all the wrong lessons.
Mm.
So now that the prime directive had been violated, the question is, would trying to make things better constitute interfering? Since
yeah.
that ship had already sailed.
Yeah.
So to bring that analogy back to climate change and ecological manipulation or novelty, if you will, the question is, okay, that ship has already sailed. We've already interfered.
Mm.
Is there now a place for us to try to interfere in a more positive way, an intentionally positive way?
Mm.
So, Star Trek, there's stuff to be learned. You're listening yes. to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. And we're going to go now into probably one more article. It's called The Treasure Trove Hidden in Discarded Computers. Again, a BBC article. And the question it poses is, what do you do with an old hard disk drive, the kind that still spins up inside most PCs once it reaches the end of its life? Now, when I read that sentence, I thought, well, what you obviously want to do is shred it because you don't want someone else accessing your data. That was the first thing I thought that this article was going to be about.
Well,
but
that's
no.
because you're technically minded, Mike.
Well, I guess. But it turns out that this went in a completely different direction. And it says, if Alan Walton has his way, parts of it could soon be propelling your next car, assuming you go electric. He's a University of Birmingham professor. He has created a firm called Hypromag. Say that three times fast. Yeah, you see how that goes. And what this company does or is learning to do is extract and recycle a rare earth called neodymium, which is used for magnets on hard drives. Neodymium is a rare earth metal, chemical elements considered essential ingredients in many of today's must-have technologies. Use it. It's used, among other things, to make magnets that turn the motors that drive electric vehicles. Walton believes that in the next 10 years, his company could be recycling enough neodymium, say that three times fast, say it one time slow, to meet a quarter of the UK's demand, almost all of which is currently imported into the UK from China. China is the largest exporter of rare earths in the world. I think they have like 70% of the market, which we'll get to a little later. Now, once electric vehicles are assembled and running, the article goes on, they're generally seen as being more environmentally friendly than cars with internal combustion engines, but the magnets that are used to make the engines are far from green. Now, steel and aluminium is what they say in the article, already have large established recycling programs to help reduce their chemical processing. Aluminum, actually, when you recycle a can, it uses about 90% less energy to recycle that aluminum than it does to make aluminum from the bauxite ore from which it would typically be extracted. Did you know that?
I did not.
Well, you see, that's what I try to do.
Yes.
Rare earth minerals are used in phones, hard drives, and even wind turbines, and generally those things are lost when they are discarded. Walton, with his mentor, discovered that running hydrogen gas, well, okay, that's technical, but in any case, he can turn the magnets into powder, which can be harvested, repacked, coated, and become new magnets. So this is also worth noting because the extraction and pre-processing of rare earths is a very, very polluting enterprise. There are areas in North China that have very high rates of diseases, environmentally caused diseases, because of the toxic materials used to extract and refine rare earths. Now, in Walton's case, speaking from a UK perspective, he believes that if Britain acts now and scales up a rare earths recycling industry, it could become a world leader, which obviously has economic benefits for them, both in terms of export and domestic demand.
Sure.
He says, or the article says, as I just did, when it comes to production of rare earths and magnets, China is the world leader. The country corners the market because its companies can mine rare earths and process them locally into finished products. More than 70% come from China, or exported by China. But while China exports processed products, the country's natural resources are not rich in the heavier types of rare earth, like neodymium. This is interesting. China gets most of its neodymium from Burma and the United States. A mining strategist said that the U.S. is one of China's largest sources of rare earths, and the Chinese are taking it for a song. They apparently own 9% of one of the larger exporters of rare earths. And he goes on to say it drives the Pentagon crazy. And we're learning from the COVID experience that a certain amount of national self-sufficiency is an important thing. So the environmental policy in China that I was discussing earlier has improved, but the largest mines were built before implementation. The processing of rare earths is horrific. There's a lot of black and gray market smuggling of the heavier rare earths. And of course, that certainly has no interest in observing environmental laws.
Right.
The article also says that COVID-19 has caused global assembly lines to grind to a halt. It has also spurred manufacturers who use rare earths to question the global supply chain and their reliance on a single source country. It's like, why didn't we think of that decades ago? Well, I did. A lot of other people did. But, you know, agree. So the crisis has pushed governments and businesses to localize resources. People like Andrew Bloodworth, the director at the British Geological Survey, have been telling their government that any production that is concentrated in small places will be vulnerable to disruption. America, the UK, and Europe are all trying to build supply chains for rare earths outside of China. On May 13th of this year, legislation was put before U.S. legislators aimed at giving tax breaks to the industry, of course. In the EU, something called the Horizon 2020 Fund has launched an initiative to build a supply chain across several European and Nordic countries, including Britain. So COVID has knocked everything sideways, according to the story, and lots of people are looking again at the way we do things. So, I mean, when I saw these stories, and these ideas have been percolating in me for a long time, it was like, this makes a nice chain of thought. It's yeah. sort of a nice, constructive way of thinking about things in terms of a process. So you've got environmental danger. Mm-hmm. You've got environmental experimentation. Mm-hmm. You've got novel ways of looking at preserving one part of the environment by introducing mm-hmm. something novel into that environment.
Right.
You're looking at experimentation that was started in the 19th century that may have lessons for us going forward. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at novel approaches to supply chains, recycling of materials that currently are being discarded because we either haven't known how to recycle them or haven't thought much about it. So there's a lot going on in the world. It's not all good, but it's not all bad. It's interesting.
Yeah. This article in particular is interesting to me because, I mean, I am as much of a, you know, tech nerd as you are, I think.
I'm just different.
This reminds me of a lot of the efforts that are in some cities by, like, nonprofit organizations to actually recycle a lot of e-waste. So, you know, laptops, desktop computers, printers, telephones, anything with a circuit board, and basically can be mm-hmm. considered e-waste. Copper,
gold, many different elements that are very valuable.
Yes. There's an organization in Minneapolis called Free Geek Twin Cities that takes like people's old e-waste and stuff, and you know, they evaluate it, they look and see, you know, can it be repaired, is it feasible to be repaired, and the stuff that's not feasible or can't be repaired, they dismantle and separate and sell it to recyclers, you know, by the pound. And
I have actually been looking for e-waste recyclers in Houston because I have some stuff accumulating.
Yeah.
And they're not necessarily convenient, and they're not necessarily easy to find, but there are a couple that I've located, and I will let folks know how that goes when I finally get out and do stuff again.
That sounds interesting, because I've been looking for charities or nonprofit organizations like Free Geek Twin Cities, which is an offshoot of the original Free Geek Project, which is somewhere else, but, you know, they're letting them, you know, use the branding and everything for name recognition. I've been looking for something like that here in Houston, but I haven't really been able to find it. So, I don't know, like, email Mike if you know of something here in Houston.
I may post it on my blog, but yeah, one way or the other, there are a few, you know, like even glass. Glass is a tricky thing to recycle now. I've been thinking maybe they really do need to put wine in cardboard boxes. Because it's like now if it's not in plastic or aluminum, it's a recycling headache, and I hate to just throw it out in the trash.
Yeah. But the other cool thing that Free Geek does is for the computers and other, you know, e-waste that they think, the items that they think, you know, somebody will actually want to buy, that can be repaired. They repair them. They pull out the hard drives. They wipe the drives of all the data, you know, multiple times over just to make sure it's all gone. And they actually get the machines back up and running and install Linux on them and sell them in a thrift store sort of space. And they, you know, at low prices, obviously, but they make technology affordable to a lot of low-income people this way. And one of the cool things about volunteering there is if you give, I think, about 100 hours in volunteer hours, every 100 hours, I think, you get to just take home a free computer that they've restored.
Well, I think it almost goes without saying, but I'll say it, that the most effective way to recycle something is to use it again.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
You know, you get back 100% of the value of the thing if you just reuse it. If you have a plastic grocery bag and you reuse it as a trash bag, then you're not buying a trash bag.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of a radical notion, but you get to use it twice. It's twice as nice.
That's why I've got a whole bag of plastic bags from Kroger behind me.
I am constantly using plastic bags so I don't have to throw out my trash every several days, and that way it doesn't stink because it's in a small bag in the big bag, and that way the bags aren't just thrown out as trash. Anyway, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. My co-host and editor is Andrew Ferguson. Thank you, Andrew. And we'll be back next week. Hopefully not at 5:30 in the morning. Everyone have a great week, and we'll talk to you later. Bye.
See you later, folks. Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm?
You may have been in your car looking for news coverage or some new music. Maybe you were at home scanning the dial looking for something different. Your radio may have settled on KPFT and stayed there. If you're new to this station, here's how community radio works. We rely on listeners, not advertisers, for money. And it's not money for nothing. We use this money to operate our station. We hold membership drives a few times a year, and we ask for you to support our work with a pledge. If you give a call to 713-526-4000 and ask for the membership department, or go to kpft.org, you can pledge an amount of your choice to support KPFT. You've come to rely on us, but we would be in dire straits without you. This is listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston.
By joining KPFT's Sustainer program this hour, you can support your local non-commercial station and help KPFT reduce its pledged drives. Rather than giving a yearly gift, Sustainers give a monthly donation that continues as long as you want. Giving 5, 20, 100, or more monthly helps change the way KPFT works. Sustainers help us meet our operating expenses with